If Christ is king, how should the Christian consider the kingdoms of this world? What does the Bible teach us about human authority and what it means to love our neighbors and our enemies? Before we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, let's know what it means to render unto God what is God's. This is the Biblical Anarchy Podcast, the modern prophetic voice against war and empire.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Biblical Anarchy Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. This week and every week on Biblical Anarchy, we seek to live counterculture to the empire of man and to instead seek the kingdom of God by unpacking what the Bible teaches about government, authority, and human relationships. I am your host, Jacob Winograd. So for today's episode, I'm going to be playing for you a segment from an interview that I did on someone else's podcast. It is the Pardon Will podcast hosted by David Lilly. I'm sorry, is it David Lilly or David Lilly? I forget the exact pronunciation. But David's a fellow libertarian Christian podcaster, and he had me on his show to have a conversation about Christian nationalism, something that he's seen growing in the culture, growing in the political discourse, different Christian nationalists out there. And there's a spectrum of them, guys like Nick Fuentes, guys like Stephen Wolf, guys like Doug Wilson, all sorts of people, even some people who are probably just using that term in a very loose, very vague, general fashion. And so obviously, if you've been following the show for a while, you know that we at the Libertarian Christian Institute have done a lot of coverage of this growing phenomenon of Christian nationalism, including a lot of coverage back at Freedom Fest of last year. And so then we kind of, you know, after we did a lot of that, we dropped it for a little bit, but I think it's good to revisit certain things. And this was one that I was happy to revisit and talk on again. And so for those of you who are new or those of you who want a refresher, this segment is just about a 20, 25 minute section of my interview with him where I kind of go over just kind of the key features of Christian nationalism, kind of lay out the map of sort of like what Christian nationalism covers and the spectrum of different beliefs found within it. And then I highlight the fundamental doctrinal and political errors of it. So I hope you enjoy this segment. If you want to hear the entire conversation, I'll have the link to David's podcast in the show notes. And yeah, hope you enjoy this conversation.
I have a question. So here lately, this issue, and I've spoken to you before, but this issue of Christian nationalism has come up on the internet a lot. And so for those who aren't, I mean, this podcast is on the internet. So obviously we're talking to people who are aware, most likely. But I refrain from bringing this topic up even on my own podcast till I caught a clip, and I brought up this last one. I caught a clip of Morning Joe with Mr. Joe Scarborough, astute scholar Scarborough. And his co-host was talking about Trump and selling a Bible, and she mentioned the Christian nationalism. And I was like, this word, and I think they came out with a book, it keeps being brought up in like an NBC and CNN, they're talking about it. So I know it's not just the Twitter sphere. Can you tell me what your thoughts are on the term Christian nationalism? And I'll bring that closer into a better question. Do you think it's a political movement or a cultural movement, or maybe both?
I guess
that's probably a better question.
So, I mean, Christian nationalism is sort of a mixture of different things. There are definitely a lot of people who would say that they are Christian nationalists who are playing a game that is not particularly political, although that has political implications. You could say there's like soft Christian nationalism where the basic framing would be that, well, we basically need to just reinstitute Christianity as the driving force in our country, and we need to be a Christian nation. And the only way the Constitution works, the only way that you know, limited government can work, the only way that, you know, we can have a functioning society is one based, you know, on a people that is primarily Christian. Okay. And so there's a lot of people who use the term more or less in that way, and that's a spectrum. So then you can go from there all the way to another end where
you don't have people like Nick Fuentes who are going to say, well, we need blasphemy laws and we need anti-sodomy laws and we need Sabbath laws. And, you know, basically, you know, Christianity needs to be enshrined in the, you know, in the law.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole lot of different, you know, grades or variants in between there. Back when I was at Freedom Fest with the Libertarian Christian Institute last year, that was in Memphis in July, we were largely talking about Christian nationalism in response to a book that came out. This was by Stephen Wolfe. He wrote the book called A Case for Christian Nationalism, which was published by Canon Press, which is associated with Doug Wilson, who is pretty big in the Reformed world. And so, you know, that book puts forth a sort of case for Christian nationalism that I would say is kind of a somewhere in the middle. And that's where a lot of Christian nationalism seems to be today. I would say most Christian nationalists are not full-blown Nick Fuentes, but right. they're usually, there's a bit of a Mott and Bailey approach here, where a lot of times they the leading pitch is, well, you know, nationalism is just a nation and we want people to be Christian. So, you know, we just want to have a Christian nation, right? And that's kind of how they reel people in. And then they start asking questions like, well, I mean, come on. Like, it's not unreasonable to say, like, you know, people shouldn't be allowed to say totally blasphemous things in the public square and not, you know, have some kind of consequence for it. Or it's not that big of a deal to have laws, you know, enforcing the Sabbath and only certain business. You know, it's like they kind of do this sort of like mission creep where they keep adding more things to what, you know, and so people will get caught, dragged into this and then kind of like the frog in boiling water, not realize how much authoritarianism is creeping into their politics and ideology. And I would say it's largely been alluring to a lot of Christians and even a lot of conservatives who I think are more or less LARPing as Christians, or they're like cultural Christians, not what I would call like a, you know,
cultural Christian. You mean like Richard Dawkins?
Exactly. I was actually just listening to that clip today.
Right. And, yeah.
You know, varying degrees of that. But yeah, so, you know, and people are, I think, allured to this because they see the excesses of the left and they feel like, well, in order to combat this growing kind of woke progressive mob, you know, we need to have a basically counter collectivism. And I've had actually people will use that term. It's like, we're going to have collectivism. We're going to have authoritarianism. We're going to have tyranny. Yeah. And so we have a choice. Those things can be driven by a progressive secular ideology, or they can be driven by a Christian nationalist ideology. So I think it's a good enough, you know, overview or summary of what Christian nationalism is. It's not like one thing. There's like an overarching, you know, sort of thing there, which is basically like, you know, pushing Christian beliefs into politics to some degree and trying to make a national identity around Christianity, but that bears out in different, you know, different shades, different extremes.
I think what you said is spot, at least from what I can see. I think the that kind of tit for tat, it's either them or us. Either the progressives are gonna, you know, mandatory that all, you know, Christians be locked up in a room and, you know, mandatory drag shows for all the kids. You have to make your kids go to it and cut their genitals off because we said so. Or we're going to steal them from you and CPS is going to come. And that whole thing has scared people. And what this particular group is coming out going, well, if they're going to do it, we're going to do it even harder and go back to the basics. I think that pendulum swing thing can catch a lot of people, but I have a hard time believing that it catches actual Christians. Where do you think the Christian, like, we need a Christian nation, that line for an actual, say, you know, just a normal Christian, they're like, hey, don't you want prayers back in school? We're like, yeah, I would love that. Wouldn't you want a Christian president who, you know, believes in Jesus? We're like, yeah, well, I want that, Jacob. I want these things. Where is the line when they start to take the train off the tracks and be like, you want the Crusades again? You're like, well, hold on, back up, dude. where is that line, do you think, that where a normal Christian hits a wall and like, oh, this is starting to turn like a cult? Where do you think that line is?
So I don't know where I would draw the line in terms of a specific issue, but on a doctrinal level, the line would be when they distort what I would say is the biblical view of civil government.
Okay.
And so I believe, and people might be confused when I say, I'm a biblical anarchy, and some people will need to be reminded, or people who are unfamiliar with anarchy will just need to have a quick lesson here.
Let's that do it.
Governance is not a synonym for the state or for statism. And so we can have governance, which would be the administration of law. There's a saying that anarchy does not mean no rules. It just means no rulers. And so what anarchism, which I think is the fullest expression of libertarianism, but what it ultimately is at the end of the day is the belief that the enforcement of law, the enforcement of, the non-aggression principle or of property rights needs to be done in a way that is consistent within its own legal framework, meaning that we cannot violate the law that we are trying to enforce in en route to enforcing it. And the problem right. with a state is that it is the introduction of a monopoly of force that is created through the initiation of violence, and without consent, without obeying proper, legal norms of property and contract and voluntary arrangement. And so, now I could back off of that and even, try to put on a minarchist hat and say that at the very least, a biblical view of civil governance could even involve like a minimal state or a night watchman state. But at the end of the day, whoever is in authority is only given that authority by God to administer very specific things. And they are there to protect the innocent and to carry out justice against the evildoer. Now, people who are in the Christian nationalist camp, people who are in tangential camps like theonomists and whatnot, will take that, like say from Romans 13, and say, well, they're there to punish evil, so that means any and all evil, and so that means, any sin. I'm like, well, first of all, we don't see that bearing out in Scripture. We don't see where Jesus is teaching that we need to use violence against people who have committed any sin. We don't see that in the apostles and the way that they conduct the affairs of their church. The most, severe punishment for unrepentant sin is just to ostracize them from the church and from, their community, but not to, initiate force and violence against them. And even in the Mosaic law, it was there were certain things that could be enforced, but that was only ever for the Jewish people. There was never any mandate that said, well, now we need to expand this to the Gentiles and to other nations. And so rather what we actually would have to understand is that because of the passing of the old covenant, which was like a eschatological intrusion into natural law, we're back to natural law, which was established in Genesis. If by a man, blood is shed, then by a man shall his blood be shed. So it's basically saying if aggression is initiated, then defensive or retaliatory aggression is warranted. And if we're talking about civil authorities, then their jurisdiction is necessarily limited to civil matters,
right?
Just like the church authority would be necessarily delegated to church matters, and parental authority is necessarily relegated to parental matters. Church doctrine or like theological systems can come into play here, although they're not explicitly from the Bible. They're derived from biblical principles. So two of my favorite doctrines are the doctrine of the lesser magistrate and the doctrine of sphere sovereignty, which comes from the Dutch Reformed tradition.
Yeah.
The doctrine of the lesser magistrate, just to sum it up, says that anything that should be enforced through civil authority should be done by the most local level possible. And then sphere sovereignty is the idea that different types of authority and different types of like society exist in different spheres. You have like the sphere of the church, you have the sphere of you know, like business, you have the sphere of the family. And although these spheres interact with each other and touch, they don't consume one another or override. Like, for example, church authority does not step into matters that are, you know, delegated to parental authority. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, my pastor has authority over things I do in church matters. Like if I am serving in a church capacity, he can direct me as to what to do on church property. There can even be like spiritual authority between Christians. He can speak into my marriage, speak into my life as I grant him that. But he can't be like, all right, you need to put your kids to bed at 7:30 and right. You can't let them watch these certain shows and yeah. You need to feed them this certain food or you need to take them to this particular, like that would be a misuse of his authority because it overstepped his sphere. In the same way, civil authority is relegated to civil matters. And so that's what Christian nationalists and similar types are missing when they're reading Romans 13. Romans 13 does say that God institutes authority, and there's all different types of authority. But if we're talking about civil authority, that means, as described by Romans 13, that they are prescribed to wield the sword to punish evildoers, but they are not a terror to good works. And again, in the civil sense, to do good means that you're not violating anyone's rights. Yeah. So therefore, we can conclude that there are a lot of things that may or may not be useful or correct to delegate to civil authority, but the clear line is that the civil authority, no matter if that's a minarchist state or I would prefer it as a polycentric legal order in like anarcho-capitalist fashion, but they're never prescribed by God to have authority to use in pursuit of cracking down with force against people who have not committed any sort of civil crime. And so that's where you have to, you know, Christian nationalists might have different issues where they cross that line. I wouldn't say there's one particular issue where they always cross it, but the minute they are saying we need to use the sword of the civil magistrate to crack down on people who have not violated anyone else's property rights, who have not initiated force against anyone, and not in the enforcement of some kind of, you know, voluntary agreement or contract, that is where the line is being crossed. You know, there are certain things where there might be some gray area, like, you know, if a local community wants to have Sabbath laws, there might be a way to do that in a way that doesn't initiate force. And so this gets into, you know, like different ways of prescribing different rules and whatnot. But the minute
that not be again, like a social credit score, but like, dude, you miss church, you only get one slice of bread this week. You know,
yeah, it could be more like financial incentives or things like that. But put it this way, what we have to do, and this is something libertarians are good at and Christians need to get better at, is stripping away language designed to obfuscate reality.
You're right. The
state is sort of a fictitious entity, and it's a shorthand that really describes a group of people.
Yeah.
And so anytime we are, and listen, I'm all for law, right? So law is basically that which comes into play when there is conflict and enforces what is just. You know, we try to find a just outcome to the conflict. If, you know, someone is trying to burn your house down, well, then it is obviously within, you know, Christian and libertarian, you know, legal theory to say that you are warranted in having a law that would say that they're not allowed to do that, which means you can enforce that law through force, which means that you're like, so if someone's trying to burn your house down, then you with a gun or men with guns are justified in preventing that or responding to stop them and to subdue them. Yeah, that's what the law is. The law is basically whatever you would justify the use of force or pointing a gun at someone to compel them to do. I would use force to compel someone to not burn my house down. But you will not find any biblical standard that says that we should point a gun at someone because they decided to, you know, keep their bakery open on the Sabbath, or because they took the Lord's name in vain, or even if they're in a sexual relationship that goes outside of what is considered moral by biblical standards, so long as it's between consenting adults. I mean, outside of consenting adults, we always have the wood chipper, as libertarians like to talk about, and that's different because that violates consent, and that, you know, the thing I'm referencing here, and
Right. Libertarians have the wood chipper. The Christians have prolonged baptism, where you just go under and you just don't let them back.
Right.
That's so, the Christian version of the wood
chipper. So if someone comes after your kids, you know, like, so there are sexual relationships where, or sexual activities that violate consent, that are aggression. But if it's two consenting adults engaging in behavior that, you know, by biblical standards are sinful, the civil authority doesn't have anything to say about that. Church authority has something to say about that. The moral law of God has something to say about that. But those are matters for God to judge, and matters for, if they're in church, for the church to have a say on, but not matters where we should be prescribing men with guns to come in and use force to compel a change in behavior.
Well, I mean, going back to, like, if someone's standing outside, this is where people get caught up, right? They get caught up in a little bit of the fanatical. It's when this conversation, well, someone's outside my house trying to burn it down, I technically have the right and justified in stopping that person by what means of force that I deem is necessary. And then the Christian nationalists will come to you and be like, dude, they're burning our country down, in some cases, literally. And then you go, okay, well, no, maybe we do need a force. But even all of the things that you described, well, even these social, like, local things, like, well, Sabbath laws, how would that work? Would there be incentivization? We're already seeing that on a secular scale on the flip reverse. And then you have, like, hate speech laws, hate crime laws. I haven't figured out what hate speech is, technically. I don't even think we've defined it. We're not defining these terms. We're just slapping things on top of them, of being like, well, we don't know what hate speech is, but this is how much you're going to have to pay, or you're going to jail for this much time.
But as much as you can't define hate speech, how can you define blasphemy laws? Because blasphemy, by whose standard?
Exactly.
Is it the Baptist standard, or is it the Catholic standard?
Yeah.
Or is it the Eastern Orthodox standard? Or is it the Charismatic Episcopalian churches? I mean, there's so many different.
Awful. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you say crap, you're going straight to the jail. Straight to
right.
jail.
Just right. From saying crap. So, I mean, you know, there's no consistent standard by which we can define what is or isn't blasphemy, just like we can't define what is or isn't hate speech. And they would say they're burning our country down, this is again where language is being used to obfuscate reality.
In some cases, they literally were. Which
I agree, right? But so what we have to get away from as Christians is the use of collective punishment and collective language that instead should be replaced with judging individuals for individual actions. So if you see people rioting in your streets and burning businesses down, yes, yeah. Use the appropriate amount of force to subdue them. And by appropriate, I mean, like, yeah, you can use men with guns. I wouldn't, to make a comparison, because I think it's useful to draw this comparison. You could describe the rioters as a sort of domestic terrorist, right? What other nation states do in pursuit of sort of like domestic or local terrorists is bomb entire city blocks down.
Right.
I wouldn't authorize that. So there is a limit to how much, you can't in your response create more victims.
Yeah.
The collateral damage isn't something that the Christian should find acceptable, but using the correct precise amount of, you know, strategic force to subdue people who are rioting and burning down property and, threatening people's lives, that's just. If it's people who are just promoting an ideology that you disagree with, that is not something that, you know, I mean, that it might be a harmful ideology and it should be something we push back on and correct in the public square, but it's not something that private actors or civil authorities would have any moral right to use force to stop.
Yeah.
And even if, you know, I mean, I would say a secondary argument would be like, you know, this is a classic libertarian critique is, you know, the power you grant the state to wield against your enemies will tomorrow be wielded by your enemies against you.
Yeah.
But you know, even if somehow you could argue away some way you could keep the power and not have it be rustled away from you, which good luck with that. But even if you could, you still wouldn't be morally justified in doing so. There's nothing about some, you know, someone just uttering words that, I mean, unless the words are like threatening, like I'm going to kill you. Like, so I guess that, you know, the Christian nationalists will try to, like you said, they'll try to push that and be like, oh, well, if they're promoting, you know, transgenderism for kids, they're promoting violence. And I mean, to some extent, I understand where they're coming
from. I mean, that's not, you could draw those lines and not have to go very far to draw them. And I think,
right?
Like, it's, and that's kind of where I get to this, because what I'm trying to figure out, and we'll go, what I'm trying to figure out is how, because I'm watching it in real time where Christians are falling into a little bit here and a little bit more and a little bit more, and kind of understand the pendulum swing, and rightfully so. What gets me is the dividing line of going, okay, this is within the Christian realm. This is within a political run. And there is a line between being a Christian and being a Christian nationalist. And that line, I would say it's a little bit more in depth than just the NAP, right? I would say it has to be a theological doctrine on it of, there is an aspect, this is why I like Christianity and libertarianism, because libertarians are very much involved in a volunteerism of all things. And I think Christianity at its core is voluntary, like at its basic core. It's just not compulsive. And I think what confuses me, and this is a side note, if Christian nationalism, if I take it at a face value, like blur it a little bit, I might not be able to tell you the difference between it and Islam, or at least the radical, you know, faction of Islam. And I'm not sure if people notice that if you blur it just a little bit, you would not be able to tell the difference. And that's what I'm saying. Like, there is a dividing. You can't tell me Christianity and Islam are the same. So what's that defining line?
All right. Well, that is all for today. Again, if you want to hear me answer that last question and hear the rest of this conversation, then I recommend going over to David's podcast, either on YouTube or on your favorite podcatcher, and listening to the rest of his show. And be sure to give him a subscribe wherever you go to watch that. And also make sure that you're subscribed to my podcast wherever you're watching it, and give this video a like or a thumbs up if you can. Or if you're watching on Apple or Spotify or anything, please, if you could leave a rating, and especially if you could leave a review, that super helps us out with the algorithms and helping to get this show out, increased into the visibility of the podcatchers and the YouTube algorithm feeds. So yeah, please do that if you haven't already. That's all I have for you today. Look forward to talking with you all next week. And remember, live at peace, live for Christ.
The Biblical Anarchy Podcast is a part of the Christians for Liberty Network, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. If you love this podcast, it helps us reach more with a message of freedom when you rate and review us on your favorite podcast apps and share with others. If you want to support the production of the Biblical Anarchy Podcast, please consider donating to the Libertarian Christian Institute at biblicalanarchypodcast.com, where you can also sign up to receive special announcements and resources related to biblical anarchy. Thanks for tuning in.